Chapter 15.
"Who are you, and why do you have Fraggara?"
Grognuel said through clenched teeth. That wasn't the question I'd been expecting. "I'm Atticus, and the sword is mine."
"He's Atticus!"
Oberon's tail was wagging, and he clearly wanted to jump on me, but he held back, seeing the tension in Grognuel. "Heck yes. Snack for you."
"Atticus is dead."
"I was only dead for a little while."
"He just helped us kill the unkillable ladies. He's on our side."
Ignoring Oberon's comment, Grognuel drew a knife from her thigh holster, her last one, and raised it over her shoulder, ready to throw.
"Tell me who you really are. Are you Loki? Coyote?"
I was beginning to understand why the elementals called her Fierce Druid. "It's easy to tell, Grognuel. Look in the magical spectrum. Loki's a mess of anger and white light. Coyote is a mix of all colors. And all you'll see from me right now is the iron in my aura because I'm not drawing on the earth at all."
"Or you could just smell him. That's Atticus. I can hear him in my head, and he promised me sausage."
I said a snack.
"I will snack on sausage, thank you very much."
Oberon's test was insufficient, and Grognuel knew it. Coyote was capable of talking mentally to Oberon, or at least hearing him as far as we knew, and he could also copy my form all the way down to my scent. The latter ability was how we'd fooled Garm and Hell into thinking I was dead back in Arizona. Grognuel exhaled sharply, and then spoke the words for magical sight. I waited patiently while she checked me out.
"What's your real name?"
she asked, still testing me, and now that I'd recovered from my surprise, I approved of her caution. "Shiahan O'Sullivan."
"I was once a vessel for another person. Name the person."
"Laksha Kuliskaran."
"And what was that one thing we did together that one time?"
"We don't discuss that in front of the Hound."
"Hey!"
Grognuel dropped the knife.
"It really is you."
I tapped the soul catcher charm on my neck. "Remember this? It actually worked." She dropped Skawaja too and tackled me to the ground. Oberon took it as an invitation to dogpile and landed heavily on the both of us.
"This is so awesome! I'm so happy right now! Atticus is back!"
Grognuel kissed me, and I got to enjoy it for maybe 2 seconds before Oberon decided to drool on our faces.
"Ooh, Oberon,"
Grognuel said, as we both wiped away the slime from our cheeks.
"Side effects from doggy joy may include face lube and leg humping."
"Don't you dare hump my leg,"
Grognuel warned.
"And please, give us some time to ourselves."
"Ah."
Oberon's tail was still waving madly back and forth, but he graciously removed his weight from us. "Grognuel, it's okay. We need to go anyway."
"We do?"
"Oh yes, this isn't over. They're not dead any more than I am. We have to keep running. We should be able to make it to France at least." Grognuel rolled off me and stood, then offered her hand to help me up.
"How are they going to heal up a decapitation?"
"They'll get help from the other Olympians. I bet Hermes and Mercury will put them back together again."
"Why not simply start over with another body?"
"Because their current bodies are in great condition. They're just missing heads. While I was running to catch up, I was thinking about their rules for regeneration. It can't be arbitrary. They can't simply wish themselves a new body. They have to suffer a certain amount of catastrophic damage."
"Decapitation isn't catastrophic?"
"Not for them. Remember the tale of Orpheus, whose head was washed out to sea and floated around until he was plucked out by women doing their washing at the shore? Their ability to remain functional is mojo on a scale we can only dream of. Probably has a lot to do with having ichor instead of blood. I bet you they're still conscious and can hear us right now."
"That is so disturbing."
"I have a plan," I said, picking up Fraggara. Grognuel retrieved her throwing knife and Skawaja.
"Of course you do."
"Hey, Atticus, do me a quick favor before we go. It's easy."
"Sure, what is it?"
"Hold Grognuel's staff for just a minute. You know, rest it on the ground so that it's like a walking stick or something, and the top of it is near your right cheek."
Granuel and I traded weapons to humor him, and I stood as he instructed.
That's perfect. Now say this like Sir Ian McKellen. I am Atticus the White, and I come back to you now at the turn of the tide.
It was too silly, and I couldn't do it, though I tried. I didn't have the gravitas. I dissolved into laughter before I could finish. I'm sorry, Oberon, we really need to move.
That's okay. I enjoyed the attempt.
So, what's the plan?
Granuel asked. Same as the last one, except now we run with heads tucked under our arms like footballs.
We run naked in plain sight with severed heads? A murder streak?
No, we'll go camouflaged if we have to escape, but I'd rather keep in plain sight for now. It's part of the plan. And so is speaking in Old Irish from now on, to keep the goddesses from listening in. Either that, or communicating mentally through Oberon.
All right, give me a sec.
She jogged over to the sad collection of hounds, presumably in search of her other two throwing knives. I found a way to keep myself occupied while she was busy doing that. The chariots of the huntresses, along with their teams, still waited a couple hundred yards away. Grinning to myself, I unbound the chariots to hunks of metal and set the stags free by unbinding their harnesses and giving them quick mental shoves. You're free.
Run.
They took off, and I wondered how willing Hephaestus and Vulcan would be to forge the huntresses yet another chariot. Granuel returned and declared herself ready. Okay, which one do you want? I asked.
I'll take Artemis.
Watch out for the mouths. I'm sure they'll bite if you give them the chance. Old Irish from now on. She looked doubtful.
Are you sure it's safe? What if they know it?
Old Irish never spread beyond Ireland, unless you want to count Scots Gaelic. The Olympians would have had no reason to learn it, especially since the Tuatha De Danann took pains to learn Greek and English. And by the time the Greeks and Irish intermingled in any great numbers, the language was transitioning to Middle Irish anyway.
What about the Romans?
They never conquered Ireland. They called it Hibernia and left it alone for the most part.
Got it.
We found the heads with little trouble and confirmed that the immortals were still very much alive. They didn't have breath to speak, lacking any physical connection with their lungs, so they did their best to glare meaningfully at us. We each tucked our grisly goddess head into the crook of a left arm and resumed running south. Soon we would swerve west again to head for Calais. The elemental promised to keep us on a rural route as much as possible to avoid being seen. I apologized first to Oberon for excluding him from the forthcoming conversation, explaining that it was intended to taunt the goddesses and not to cut him out.
That's fine, Atticus. I'm just happy you're back.
Me too, buddy. Switching to Old Irish, I said to Granuel, the main reason I know this isn't the end of things is because the Morrigan said we wouldn't be safe until we reach Windsor Forest. That's still a good run ahead of us.
Why do you think the rest of the Olympians haven't gotten involved?
I'm sure it has something to do with pride. The huntresses want to claim our kills as their own, though they'd never be able to touch us if we were able to shift planes. And when it comes to the rest of the Olympians, Odin said they're under orders to keep out of it from other deities, though I don't know which ones. So I'm certain the Olympians are watching the hunt, but they're also acutely aware that others are watching it too. Odin isn't the only one keeping track, you can be sure.
Oh, they're tracking me, you mean?
Yes, you are not so anonymous as you once were. But my point was that this is now an inter-pantheon power play. We removed Bacchus from the board, so now they've killed the Morrigan and penciled in a hash mark under the column that says Badass. If they can't finish us off, though, with everyone watching, then that makes the Morrigan's death a fluke. Or what it truly was, which was suicide.
Suicide?
Yes. The chooser of the slain chose herself.
But why?
I wasn't ready to discuss that with her yet. Primarily, of course, the Morrigan had felt all the weight of an eternal prison sentence. She could never change who she was because of the constraints of belief. But the question of why she wanted to change would lead to a discussion of our strange relationship. The revelation that the Morrigan had loved me dumped a load of guilt ferrets on the back of my neck, and I hadn't managed to shake them free. I doubted it would be a comfortable topic of conversation. We'd have to talk of it soon, but now wasn't the best time. Let's talk about her later, if you don't mind, I said.
Okay, as long as we don't forget.
I won't.
You were saying about the Olympians.
They're going to be anxious to keep this confined to the Huntresses as much as possible. The more effort they have to expend in taking us out, the smaller their victory over the Morrigan and the more ridiculous they appear. I mean, entirely apart from the fact that they were forbidden to interfere, they would diminish themselves in the eyes of every other pantheon if they have to exert their full might to be rid of us. That's probably why they can't see past our camouflage. This time Minerva is staying out of it.
But they've already involved quite a few of them. Neptune started that earthquake back in Romania, and then you have Pan and Faunus spreading pandemonium to keep us from shifting. And the Forge Gods made them new chariots, right?
Exactly. It's bad enough as it is. But if snuffing us was all that mattered to them, consequences be damned, they could have done it by now. Say that Ares, Mars, Athena, and Minerva dropped down right here, now in front of us, and both of the Apollos. Would we stand a realistic chance of taking them out if they were fully prepared?
Eek! No, guess not.
You guess right. They're all weakened compared to their glory days, but they're still powerful beings and more than a match for us if we can't surprise them. That means our deaths aren't paramount yet. How we die is still more important, so there's definitely politics at work here. We spent some time after that catching up on what had happened between me getting shot and arriving in time to dispatch Artemis.
I think Granuel edited out some of what she felt and thought while she believed me dead, but that was okay.
I didn't tell her everything I thought and felt when I was in the gray wash of depression either. Our run southwest passed quite pleasantly until Hermes and Mercury paid us a visit. They accosted us before we could cross the border into Belgium. They dropped down from the sky on their wee ankle wings and hovered, keeping pace until we stopped. Mercury did all the talking, as usual, while Hermes stared on silently.
"Release the goddesses,"
Mercury demanded in English without preamble. "Oh, hi, guys." I waved at them with Fragoron, smiled. "Are you speaking for yourselves or delivering a message?"
"These are the words of Jupiter and Zeus."
"Nice. Very nice. Well, you might have noticed that I don't respond well to commands. Are you willing to talk a little bit this time, or are you here to deliver another ultimatum and then unleash some more Olympians on me when I refuse?" Mercury seethed, but confined himself to saying,
"You wish to speak, mortal? Then speak."
"Thanks. Last time you didn't seem very anxious to listen. Kind of makes me wonder how much you care about Bacchus, actually, since if you kill us, you'll never get him back. Did I make that plain earlier? No one knows where he is but us. You can't ask the Duaha Dedannan. They have no clue."
"So he is a hostage?"
"No, he's not a hostage. I don't want any ransom in a bag of unmarked bills. I'm perfectly fine with leaving him where he is. And if you are fine with it too, which it seems you are since you've been busy trying to kill us, then we're actually on the same team here, and I'm not sure why you're so hostile. Could you clarify that for us? Do you want Bacchus back, or are you willing to write him off?" The messenger gods exchanged glances, and then Mercury sighed.
"We want him back."
"Awesome. Thank you for admitting it. I will freely admit to you that I would like to be left alone. In fact, the entire reason we're here is because you won't leave me alone. I didn't pick this fight, okay? Bacchus and Faunus did. So, the solution here is very simple, and I would appreciate it if you would relay my proposal to Jupiter and Zeus." Mercury nodded, and Hermes blinked to indicate that they were listening. "There's only one rule. Don't fuck with the druids. The best part about that rule is that it requires no effort to follow. Easiest rule in the world. You can have the Huntress's heads back when you agree you won't allow them to hunt us, or pursue any kind of vengeance on us through surrogates or associates of any kind. And the same goes for Bacchus. I'll happily give him back to you once I'm assured he won't be allowed to pursue his inclination to destroy us. And just to be safe, that goes for all the Olympians. If Jupiter and Zeus give me their word that members of their pantheon won't keep attacking us, then we won't have to keep defending ourselves and humiliating your dumb asses." I thrust Diana's head out to him by way of punctuation. Message ends. Mercury sneered at first, but then grew uncertain when he took a closer look at Diana.
We will deliver you even so.
He and Hermes launched themselves into the sky and disappeared into the sun.
That was less than diplomatic,
Granuel commented, using Old Irish. I responded in kind. I know, but there's nothing to be gained here with a soft shoe. The sky gods aren't being serious yet. They're sending minions to make the demands of us. We're going to have to up the stakes to make them pay attention.
How do we up the stakes?
We'll figure it out in England. The Morgans saw a way for us there, but damn if I know what it is. Until we're there, all we can do is buy time, and I just bought us a bit more. Let's keep running.
Yes, let's.
Granuel's eyes dropped down from my face and landed on Diana's head, whereupon she gasped.
Atticus, wait. Is Diana, you know, still with us?
What? I peered at Diana and saw that she was slack-jawed. She'd never struck me as the mouth-breathing type, and even if she was, there was no way she could breathe at the moment. Turning my body so that my back was to Granuel, and therefore to Artemis, I untucked the head from my arm and held it in both hands. Diana's eyes were closed, and her mouth hung open. I lightly slapped one cheek to see if I got a reaction, even reflexive. Nothing. I shut her jaw and it fell back open. Being careful to continue speaking Old Irish, I asked over my shoulder, "How is your goddess doing?"
"She's fine. I mean, she looks more than a little angry, but she's alive. Yours?"
"Well, we may have a problem." I cast magical sight and saw that the white glow of Diana's power was gone. So was her entire aura. She appeared to be truly dead. "Hold up your head for me," I asked. I craned my neck around and saw that Artemis still shone with energy. "Okay, thanks." Diana had none of that anymore, and it dawned on me that my cold iron aura must have slowly snuffed out the magic that was keeping her alive. It hadn't been quick, like the nearly instant disintegration of fairies when they touched me, but a gradual process that required prolonged contact. The question that worried me was whether she was forever done, or if she would be able to begin anew at Olympus, an idea of virtue and ambrosia made flesh. Had I unwittingly turned her mortal, in other words, or was she only mostly dead? The longer I lingered there, the greater chance that a divine observer would figure out what happened, if they didn't know already. Thinking back to his reaction before he flew away, Mercury might have figured it out. I hope not. It would be best if the Olympians didn't know I could do this. Tucking her head back under my arm as if nothing had changed, I said, "Let's go, but you run a bit ahead. I don't want Artemis to see what happened." Granuel resumed running, but called over her shoulder.
"Is she toast?"
"Tough to say. I think we'll get some kind of reaction from Olympus soon. If they come for Artemis, bust her head before you let them have it."
"Ugh, seems wrong somehow."
"You mean now that she's helpless? It's not murder if you can't kill her. It's more like redistributing her consciousness. Only other gods can kill them."
"Unless you just did it."
"Right. Aside from cutting off her head, though, I didn't really mean to kill her." Granuel laughed.
"You know I'm on your side, but to an objective listener, that sounds like a less than convincing argument."
"I know. We'll have to wait and see." As we crossed into Belgium and wove a sinuous path through farms and villages and around cities, occasionally earning a honk from a driver who spotted us along a rural road, storm clouds gathered overhead, darkening the Belgian morning commute. I think Zeus and Jupiter have received our message. We can expect their reply shortly.
What do you think they'll say?
I don't think they'll say anything.
Then how is it a reply?
Two thunderbolts lanced down from the clouds above and struck us. Our fulgurite talismans provided protection, but the sentiment was unmistakable. "That's their reply," I said, and it was nothing more than I expected. But what followed was completely unexpected.
"Hey, watch out," Oberon said,
running behind us, but it wasn't in time to prevent Hermes and Mercury from swooping in behind us and batting the heads out of our arms with their caduceus... is... caducei? Who's ever had to deal with more than one caduceus before? Neither had popped up helpfully and allowed the messenger gods to scoop them up on the fly. They dropped at our feet, merely dislodged, and tumbled along as we slowed to pick them back up. We couldn't let Hermes and Mercury escape with the heads intact. For one thing, they'd find out for sure what had happened to Diana. For another, they'd be able to put Artemis back together fairly quickly, and then she'd be only an hour or so behind us. I was already carrying Phragaron in my right hand, so it was a simple matter to shuck it out of its scabbard and have Diana's head before Mercury could circle around to pick it up. It was not so simple for Granuel, however, to take care of Artemis. Hermes was a bit quicker on his second pass, or else the head had rolled a bit farther from her feet, and it was all Granuel could do to fight him off with her staff and prevent him from picking it up. She was probably 30 yards ahead, and if I went to help, we'd have Mercury trying to get involved too. I had to keep my eyes on him, or else he would doubtless take advantage when my back was turned. His cursing in Latin certainly indicated he'd like nothing more. "Oberon, wanna play fetch?"
"On it,"
he said, understanding precisely what I meant. While Granuel and I kept the flyboys at bay, he scampered over and scooped up Artemis in his jaws, grasping her ponytail like a tug toy and letting her head dangle off to the left side of his snout. Hermes shouted when he saw that, and I stole a quick glance to see what had happened. "Good," I said, returning my eyes to Mercury. "Now, bring her over here and drop her at my feet." Both Hermes and Mercury tried to intercept Oberon by flying over us, but we backpedaled and Oberon dodged the one pass they had at him. He dropped Artemis at my feet, and I ended it with a wet, chunky sound. The Olympians roared in outrage.
"Oh, stop," I said. "They'll be fine again before the day is through, and you know it. If Zeus and Jupiter would come talk to me, we wouldn't have to go through this."
They didn't answer, neither did they attack. Coming after the heads in an attempt to restore the huntresses was one thing, but striking at us and involving themselves in the hunt would violate the terms Odin had outlined earlier. They floated above us, quaking with the desire to show us what an airstrike truly meant, but we simply set ourselves and waited, saying nothing as the storm clouds boiled overhead. Eventually, they flew back south toward Olympus, and our tense muscles could relax.
"They're not very nice to animals," Oberon observed. "How did they ever become the visual symbol of flower delivery?"
Chapter 16. There was no rest for us in Belgium. We stopped only once, and it wasn't for food, which prevented me from investigating a modern mystery. What do people in Belgium call Belgian waffles? Our waffles, perhaps, or maybe national breakfast pastries? It remains for me an inscrutable conundrum. And so it goes for Belgian chocolate and Belgian witbier. I had spent very little time in Belgium since its rise to international fame for delicious foodstuffs. I supposed I would have to use the modern fallback position and Google it. The reason for our pause was Hugin and Moonin, who flew in to give us an update from the All Odin All the Time news channel. Moonin pointed at Hugin, indicating the raven with which I was to bond. Odin's speech filled my head like Oberon's did, though it was still a bit odd staring at a raven instead of his one-eyed visage.
"The Alfar have successfully destroyed 30 Svartalfar who were lying in wait along your path. They have asked me to relay their gratitude for the opportunity."
The Alfar took out 30 dark elves? "Oh, well, they're very welcome. I'll send them some fine Irish whiskey as soon as possible, if you'll be so kind as to deliver it to them. Because if someone saves you from a potentially life-threatening fight, you owe them booze. It's a rule that transcends time and cultures."
"Of course. Of more importance is the fact that the Olympians have ascertained your heading for the English Channel. Neptune and Poseidon are stirring up the ocean there. I have heard this from my own god of the sea, Aegir. You should prepare for some sort of trickery. What's the Irish word I'm looking for?
Shenanigans.
Yes, that's it, Odin said. Shenanigans.
My aquatic form was a sea otter, and Granuel could shapeshift into a sea lion. While we could swim the channel like that, and Oberon could dog paddle, we weren't going to kick a lot of ass if the Olympian sea gods got involved. And I could see already how they would rationalize what they were doing. If we were eaten by sharks, well, that happened all the time. It wasn't direct interference in the hunt. Though I'd already determined it would be unwise, I asked anyway to see what Odin would say. Can't we just take the Eurostar train underneath the channel and avoid all that?
You can try. If you think you can sneak past the sentries they have at the station and wish to trap yourself in the metal container with plenty of innocent people, and if you wish to break the rules of engagement that prevent them from flying down in front of your current location, by all means, go right ahead.
He knew very well I wouldn't do that. What about Artemis and Diana? Any word on them?
They are back in Olympus, breaking in their new bodies, awaiting yet another set of chariots to be made. They will not be on the trail again for some time.
I breathed a private sigh of relief, and not just for the extra time. I was glad Diana hadn't died a true death, for if she had, there would have been no possibility of a negotiated peace between us. Odin added,
I found your treatment of their heads to be amusing.
Yes, well, I'm sure they found it less so. Listen, Odin, I need a favor if you can manage it. Get word to Mananon MacLear of the Tuatha De Danann what's been happening. And Flitish too, I guess. We need some Irish help to get across the channel, because we don't have anything that can skate us past Poseidon and Neptune, and we'll probably need Flitish to help us in the UK after that. The raven squawked at me, and Odin's voice said,
I am not your errand boy.
I know, and I said it's a favor. I sensed that Odin wasn't opposed to helping me, but I'd failed to throw a sufficient sop to his ego first. Thanks to a meal I once shared with Odin and Frigg, I remembered that the Norse diet in Valhalla was quite restricted and unvarying, and Odin might be tempted with gustatory delights. In thanks for which, I'll send you some Irish whiskey too, plus some Girl Scout cookies. He could no doubt secure such items on his own if he truly wanted them, but things always taste better when they have the added flavor of contraband.
Oh, well, if we are exchanging services, that's entirely different. I want a gross of those Samoas I overheard you mentioning to the witches in Poland, and a case of Redbreast. And I mean the 15-year-old stuff. Non-negotiable.
Done. As long as Mananon shows up and we survive.
I will do my utmost to ensure he appears. A question before I go. Do you know anything about the vampire situation?
What vampire situation?
Rome is in an uproar. Or rather, I should say the rest of the world is. Rome itself is now silent. 27 vampires, all of them quite old and part of the vampire's power structure, were slain yesterday during daylight, their heads missing.
I frowned. Only vampires? Didn't they have human bodyguards?
Thralls, yes. Also dead. Their deaths are not causing the uproar.
Interesting.
You know nothing about it?
I knew all about it. I'd asked Govnu to arrange the whole enterprise the last time we were in Tir na n'Og. The idea was to put a bounty on vampire heads, starting with the heart of their power in Rome, and let all the pods of mercenary human know. I couldn't have known it would work so well, or that they'd coordinate and take out every vampire in the city, but I'd hoped for a significant disruption to the vampire chain of command. This sounded like a complete decapitation of their leaders, literally, and it might explain why we hadn't seen any more vampires since the Polish border, as well as why Leif might be too busy to deliver his own messages. Odin didn't need to know that, however. There was no telling who else he was talking to, and I didn't need to have the mysterious puppet master in Tir na n'Og hearing about it and letting the vampires know that I was paying for their heads. Nope, I said. Not a thing beyond what you've told me. It certainly brings me joy to hear it, though.
They were looking for you, weren't they? This should ensure that they remain preoccupied with their internal affairs for the near future, which coincidentally benefits you, doesn't it?
It's a happy coincidence, I agreed. Theophilus struck me as the sort who preferred to rule from the shadows and not get directly involved. But I bet he would either be required to rule himself now or expend all his efforts in putting some puppets in charge. One of those might be Leaf. And I'm sure Leaf would be figuring out how to turn the situation to his advantage, as would every other vampire.
Yes, Odin said,
Hugin's head cocking to the side, and managing to convey that Odin didn't think it was a coincidence at all.
Well, I'm off to find your sea god. You can leave the cookies and whiskey at the drop point in Colorado.
Many thanks, Odin.
I am grateful to you for the entertainment. The Einherjar are betting heavily on the outcome, and your return from the dead caused settled bets to become unsettled. The fights that have broken out have been inspired. How did you manage to come back from a bullet to the head, by the way?
I shrugged as if it were nothing. He didn't need to know that. How are the odds?
In your favor now, Odin replied. But they're betting the woman and the dog don't make it. 3-1 against.
I broke the connection before I said something unforgivably rude. Chapter 17. We arrived in Calais, France, around 1 in the afternoon. Timing and mental exhaustion required an interlude. We needed to give Odin time to find Mananon MacLear, and we had a comfortable lead on the Huntresses, so we could afford to relax, or at least not run, and have a decent meal before crossing the channel at night. We snuck into a clothier to grab some duds and walked out looking at least civilized, if not fashionable. We also lifted 6 leather belts for later use. I took note of the name to make sure the establishment got paid later for what we took. Not trusting ourselves to nap briefly, we chose to remain awake and explore the city for a few hours. I kept my eyes peeled for possible enemies, but tried to conceal my paranoia. We all studiously avoided talking of the immediate past or the future. We were both desperate, I think, for a thin slice of normalcy. I taught Granuel a few French words here and there, and taught Oberon that the food he wanted was called saucisse. We pulled off another meat heist in a cafe, but the food was rather pedestrian in Oberon's view compared to what he'd had in Poland. It took the edge off our hunger until we could enjoy something later, however. After sundown, we walked to a spot near the channel and found a likely-looking place to have dinner, called Le Grand Bleu. Before walking in, I asked Granuel and Oberon to wait while I made arrangements. Casting camouflage on myself, I borrowed a cell phone from the purse of an unsuspecting teenager to call my attorney, Hal Hawk, back in Arizona. I walked a short distance behind her as I called. She missed the phone a bit quicker than I had hoped, due to an addictive need to check for texts or something every few minutes. Her cursing in French was entertaining, but I couldn't appreciate its fluency once Hal answered his cell phone.
"Whoever you are, it's 4 in the morning here," he said without preamble. "This had better be good."
"Hi, Hal," I said, sounding as cheerful as possible. "It's me, Atticus, on the run in France without ID or money. Need the money right away. Know anybody in Calais?" Hal groaned.
"You're going to give me a headache, aren't you?"
His gruff voice rumbled. "Your kind don't get headaches," I reminded him. We stuck to vague words because it wouldn't be wise to have terms like pack and werewolves bouncing around communication satellites.
"That doesn't mean you aren't one," he said. "To answer your question, I believe there's someone nearby, yes."
"Can someone meet us at a restaurant called Le Grand Bleu and drop a wad of euros in my hand and you wire them some reimbursement from one of my accounts?"
"Of course I can. But what sort of trouble are you in now?"
"Everyone's trying to kill me. So far, they've only managed to do it once."
"What?"
"The good news is that Granuel is now a full druid."
"That's great, but who's after you?"
I couldn't very well tell him plainly without making eavesdroppers raise a red flag, so I improvised a toupee for the bald truth. Well, I'm running from several different LARPing troops. Hal caught on and said,
Of course. Which ones?
The Fae, the Svartalfar, all the vampires and the Olympians, plus Hel and Loki. Hal ignored everything except the last.
Loki. Loki is free in the world. LARPing, I mean.
Well, to some extent, yeah. The backstory for his role is that he busted out of his binding a few months ago, but he's been napping for much of that time, trying to heal up a bit after centuries of scarring and sleep deprivation. I've been able to distract him from the business of Ragnarok with one shenanigan or another, and right now he's under the control of Melina's coven in Poland. Oh, and before I forget, do you remember that cabin in Colorado I had you buy for me?
Yes.
Good. I need you to buy a case of 15-year-old Redbreast whiskey and somehow get your hands on a gross of Samoas and put them in the cabin right away. Send Greta to do it or something. Silence greeted this for several seconds, and I began to fear I'd lost the connection. Just as I was about to check, Hal said,
Pardon me, is this some kind of social experiment? You want me to get 144 Samoans and cram them into your cabin with a case of whiskey?
No, I said Samoas, the Girl Scout cookies with chocolate and coconut. Luxury item outside of the States, you know. I've seen them go for $50 on the Malaysian black market, but they're only $4 a box for us. The problem is, they're out of season right now, so it's going to be tough.
Out of season?
Yeah, they don't sell them year-round, Hal. It's usually January through April, and here we are in October. I'm sure you can find them somewhere, but it's going to be tough. This is a major quest I'm giving you here.
I am too old to be chasing after Girl Scout cookies.
Well, I'm older, and I'm paying you to be my little cookie monster.
This is not why I have a law degree.
No, but the law degree is why you get to charge me that hourly rate. Hal sighed audibly through the phone. His frustration carried across the Atlantic very well.
How did our conversation get to this place? I mean, didn't we start with everyone trying to kill you? Let's go back to the part where you said they already killed you once.
Hal, I don't have time to explain. I borrowed this phone and need to give it back. Just have an associate of yours show up at Le Grand Bleu with a fat stack of bills and get that contraband to the cabin. Pretty please?
Fine, but I'm going to bill you for my therapy session.
You do that. Oh, and we have a few local vendors who would probably appreciate some reimbursement for my activities today. Have your dude also drop off a few hundred euros at this store. I gave him the address of the clothier as well as the cafe from which we'd snaffled lunch, and he quickly rang off before I could think of anything else for him to do. I slipped the phone back into the teen's purse and then dissolved my camouflage. Granuel was about a half block away with Oberon sitting by her side, and he was getting plenty of attention.
Ah, the French are so lovely,
he commented as a pair of women paused to smile at him and scratch him behind the ears.
Great food, amusing little bulldogs, and super hot poodles. They have made their mark on the world, have they not? But yet they also appreciate the greatness of the Irish, me, and that is why their hands are so soft. They honor me with their soft hands.
Oberon, you're doing that thing again when your ego replaces your reason.
Sorry? I didn't get that. I'm too busy being adored. What's that they're saying right now? They're telling me I'm a good boy in French, aren't they? They sound so sweet. It's like they're feeding my ears with sugar while massaging them with those wonderful fingers at the same time.
Don't get carried away now.
I can't help it. They moisturize. Haven't you ever heard of lotion, Atticus?
I ignored his jibe and said, We're going to be heading indoors to eat. Ready to squeeze underneath a table?
Not really. Can I take a nap while you go do your knife and fork thing, and then you can bring me something in a doggy bag?
Okay. Where do you want to plonk down? Oberon wandered around to the rear of the restaurant and stretched out against the wall.
Unconsciousness in T-minus 5 minutes. 5, 4...
You mean seconds?
Whatever.
I cast camouflage on him to prevent someone from calling in astray, and then took Granuel's hand and squeezed it gently. For another hour, perhaps two, we would have some time to enjoy our lives instead of running for them. She smiled at me and leaned in for a quick kiss. We decided, however, to give it an extended run.
Oh, bof. Human mating habits. If this was a movie, I would skip to the next scene.
You're supposed to be asleep.
Well, I would be, except that there are these people mashing their faces together in front of me.
We granted him mercy and circled the building to get a table in the restaurant, camouflaging our weapons and taking them inside. Tables of a light wood awaited us, along with rattan-style chairs in a cold gray. We eschewed alcohol, we'd be swimming soon, but ordered some challenging items for our digestive systems. I opted for something that translated literally to monkfish in an algae shirt, but monkfish are famously unconcerned with wearing clothing. It really meant that the monkfish was wrapped in seaweed, but privately I thought the algae shirts would be a great band name. Incredible merchandising potential. Granuel wanted fish too, but wasn't feeling up to the monkfish, so after asking me for a wee bit of coaching on pronunciation, she ordered
turbo hollandaise au citron vert, écrasé de pommes de terre, crème de ciboulette.
The waiter, a tall gentleman with heavy eyelids, bobbed his chin and said,
Oui, mademoiselle.
She grinned with victory as he departed.
That was fun to say. I've enjoyed all these little phrases I've picked up today. I think I should learn French next.
I agree. Let us begin. Repeat after me.
J'ai l'air ridicule quand je ne sais pas ce que je dis.
Wait, I heard a cognate in there. Something about ridiculous. You're setting me up to say something stupid, aren't you?
Ah, you caught me. She smiled briefly before her expression turned serious.
How long do you think it will take us to cross the channel?
It's a 21-mile swim, so however long it takes Oberon to dog paddle the whole way. It might be a very long time, unless you think you'd be strong enough to kind of tow him along and speed up the process. She pursed her lips in uncertainty.
I haven't even tried to swim yet. I have no experience with that form. We haven't even been by the sea in the past few weeks since I've been bound. But towing 150 pounds of wet dog doesn't sound easy.
Well, it won't be dead weight. He's going to be helping. Hopefully we'll have time to experiment. We'll use the belts to jury-rig a harness for the weapons first, and then if we can figure out something for Oberon too, great. But if not, we'll basically swim circles around Oberon to make sure nothing's coming at us. That earned me a Billy Idol lip curl.
Something's going to come at us, isn't it?
I nodded. Odin revealed that it's Poseidon and Neptune's job to make sure we never make it to England. I don't think they'll content themselves with waves.
So, what do we do?
The same thing that Poseidon and Neptune will do. If they can influence the animals of the sea, so can we. You look at them in the magical spectrum and attempt to communicate with them, the same way you made the initial connection with Oberon. Try to convince them that we taste like ass, or there's something shiny waiting for them in the Black Sea, or whatever, just don't eat us.
We're not going to have access to magic while we swim.
Nope. Whatever I can store in my bear charm will have to last us the entire way across. We should cast magical sight while we're still in the shallows and keep it on all the way.
We need to make, like, 10 more of those bear charms.
Yeah, it's tough to argue that. But it might be more important to bind your amulet to your aura first. Everyone who wants to find me can do it now by finding you. The only reason we're staying mildly ahead of them is because we keep moving, but that's not sustainable.
Tell me about it.
Well, a cultured voice said, I found you the old-fashioned way, a wiretap.
Our heads swiveled in alarm as our hands reached for weapons. Leif Helgerson, living embodiment of a frenemy, stood stiffly with his hands clasped together in front of him. He was out of reach beyond the neighboring table, but he could get into reach quickly if he wished.
Though I admit, I was informed ahead of time which city you would be in. Hal is not so security-conscious as Gunnar was, have you noticed? He should be using a scrambler.
What I noticed was that Leif had ceased trying to blend in, not that he had ever been especially good at it. He was wearing a black paisley waistcoat over a white shirt and a candy-apple-red cravat pinned with a pearl. Black skinny pants and shiny, pointy black shoes completed his look, which suggested to me mild mental illness. Since when did you start monitoring calls?
Working with Theophilus has given me access to technologies and methods I would not have used earlier. I have been monitoring all calls running through the cell towers near Hal's residence and place of business, so thank you for reaching out to him.
It's not a wiretap if you're not actually tapping a wire, I said, in a peevish attempt to reassert control. A small part of me was relieved that Leaf wasn't able to track me through all the blood we had shared. He used to drink mine in lieu of payment for his services, and I think I probably ingested some of his once back in Flagstaff, so that had been a legitimate fear of mine after he'd surprised us that time in Thessalonica. Tracking Granuel through divination and monitoring calls was annoying, but at least we could work on countermeasures against that. I couldn't take back the blood. Now get out. We were trying to have a romantic interlude, and your cravat is ruining everything.
Your conversation sounded rather prosaic and based on survival rather than procreation to me.
Who said anything about procreation? The point, which you apparently missed, is that you're not welcome.
Where are the Dark Elves this time?
Granuel asked, looking over his shoulder.
Are they in the kitchen?
No Dark Elves at all, Leaf replied. Though some other vampires may arrive shortly.
Please, wake Oberon and get him in here, I said to Granuel, never taking my eyes off Leaf. Look out for threats while we talk. Leaf wouldn't leave before he'd spoken his piece, so I ground out,
Say what you came to say.
All right, coming,
I heard Oberon grouse in response to Granuel's mental call. Leaf gestured to the empty chair next to me.
May I join you?
No. Over there. I flicked my eyes at the unoccupied table across from us.
Very well.
No sooner had he seated himself than our waiter swooped in to inquire about getting him a drink. Leaf caught his eye, charming him, and said,
You will forget I am here. Ignore me.
The waiter turned and shook his head once, wondering what he'd been doing before retreating to the kitchen to see if the answer waited for him there. Oberon, invisible to most everyone, joined us and squeezed in behind Granuel's chair.
Whoa, that's Leaf, he said. We don't like this guy, right? Do I need to open a can of Wolfhound?
I decided to let Granuel answer him and prompted my erstwhile attorney. Why are you here?
I have been given a task to perform, which I have no intention of performing. It runs counter to my own interest, despite the attempts of Theophilus to ensure that I have a personal stake in its completion.
And that task is what, exactly? Kill us?
Near enough, Leaf admitted. I am to prevent you from swimming the channel, or, at minimum, delay your crossing. I therefore urge you to depart sooner rather than later.
Fine by me, I said, making as if to rise. Leaf held up a pale, placating hand.
Nonsense. Enjoy your meals first. The urgency is not so great as that, and we have other things to discuss.
Such as the note you left for me in Germany.
I am glad you received it. I have heard that you killed one of the snipers.
There was more than one?
There were five. The one you killed was at the edge of the net, so to speak. Had you continued straight ahead from the place where you found the note, you would have been caught in a crossfire.
I didn't bother correcting him on who had killed the sniper. Whose idea was that, and how did they know to set up there?
As to the latter, you probably know better than I. It is someone in Tir na n'Og who is divining the future of your protégé.
He waved a finger at Granuel. Do you know who it is?
No. Theophilus is quite closed-mouthed about it. All I know is that he gets regular updates from his source on your future or current position. As soon as the sun set, we heard you would be in Calais this evening, and I was sent immediately to cut you off. I am supposed to coordinate with the local vampires and one other to prevent your escape. Naturally, you are the wild card in all of this. Your amulet prevents them from predicting your actions, and thus they never know whether they will be successful.
The waiter arrived with our orders and placed the artfully arranged plates in front of us. We thanked him, and he left without looking at Leaf. Where's Theophilus now?
A tiny shrug. He is constantly on the move now, as am I, but I believe he is somewhere in Italy at the moment.
Good. Leaf quirked an eyebrow.
is it?
Yes, I said. Perhaps the human would find him and deliver the vengeance of druids. I wondered if Leif had heard about what had happened in Rome, but I didn't want to bring it up. Was it his idea to send the snipers?
No, but he approved it. The idea came from one of his allies, who rather concerns me, an Austrian fellow named Werner Drasch. You may have the misfortune to meet him shortly. He bankrolled the mercenaries and has the wherewithal to continue such activity. It is his opinion that modern military force would be most effective in bringing you down.
He was right about that. I noted that Granuel fumed silently at this news, and I felt a bit sorry for Herr Drasch. He was now irrevocably on her shit list. Interesting, I said. Why would I meet him shortly?
Theophilus has sent him here with the same basic information I was given, namely that you would be in Calais tonight. He is probably searching for you even now, as I would be had I not heard from a hireling about your call to Hal.
A hireling? Granuel said. Who talks like that?
A contracted employee,
Leif amended, which was not much better. Why should I be worried about this guy? Is he a vampire? Leif shook his head once, curtly.
No, he is human, or at least he once was. You cannot simply unbind him. Think of him as a vampire without the common disadvantages. He is not dead. He can walk in the daylight. Wood is no more dangerous to him than any other substance. And yet he enjoys many of our advantages. Superior strength, long life, extraordinary recuperative powers, and an ability to hide his feeding so that no one notices.
What is he, then?
I cannot say with certainty. A horror born of madness, perhaps. I have only recently met him, and my investigations have yet to bear fruit. But if you ask him, he will say that he is an arcane life leech.
An arcane life leech? Leif winced.
He does have a penchant for melodrama. And cravats.
Oh. I dipped my chin at his throat. So that thing on your neck wasn't your idea?
It was my idea to flatter him into thinking he influences my personal tastes. But it is not my idea that cravats are attractive.
I'm relieved. So, what does Herr Drasch do? Latch onto his victims and drain their life?
He does nothing physically. He can do it from a distance. Hence his use of the word arcane.
I frowned. How great a distance?
I cannot provide an accurate measurement, but within his sight, certainly. He cannot hide in Sri Lanka and drain a victim in the Seychelles. But he could stand at the door to this establishment, for example, and leech the very life from your cells. A little from you, a little from Granuel, and a little from everyone else.
He swept his hand around to include the entire restaurant.
You may not feel anything at all, except perhaps a mild fatigue. He is the perfect parasite. He thrives entirely on the energy of others now, and has no need to ingest food, only water.
So he can just drain a little at a time?
Oh no, he can drain people completely. He refrains, however, because it is unnecessary. Imagine Atticus. He can walk abroad in daylight and sample from everyone in public. He is sustained and kept youthful wherever he goes.
This only works on people?
No, plants and animals too. He can live until the end of days if he so chooses and have minimal impact on his surroundings. Yet, if he needs unnatural strength, it is at his fingertips. He can grow stronger by draining the life of everything around him.
Gods below, what a monster. Given enough time, he could snuff an elemental.
Indeed, but apart from some odd cosmetic decisions, he does not look the part of a monster. Instead, he cultivates the aspect of a dandy.
I snorted. Nobody calls people dandies anymore, Leif. We call them douchebags now.
In sooth?
Verily. And in case you were wondering, you're dressed like a dandy.
Alas, it is the least of my faults, I imagine.
Truer words were never spoken. I could never forgive his betrayal, but somehow I had slipped into bantering with him like old times. I looked down at my plate and realized I had yet to touch my food. Granuel hadn't sampled hers either and became aware of this at the same time I did. Leaf noticed our gazes and said, "Please, eat." The monkfish in algae shirts looked tasty, but I was no longer hungry. I've kind of lost my appetite.
"Me too,"
Granuel said. Oberon spoke up.
"What a shame! Happily, I found mine."
Granuel picked up a fork, scooped a bite of turbo, and held it out to her right, over seemingly empty space. A couple of licking noises later, the turbo had disappeared from the fork.
"How can such a creature as a life leech exist?"
Granuel asked. Leaf grimaced.
"I am uncertain. My only information derives directly from him and may be suspect. But to hear him tell it, he was an accident of alchemy, a byproduct of a 16th century search for the Philosopher's Stone. He represented a form of success, of course, but he drained to death the alchemist who created him in the first few minutes of his newfound power. He is unique, which I suppose is a minor blessing, as there will be no others. Of more concern to us is that he is entirely in the confidence of Theophilus."
I noticed that Leaf had subtly cast this as an us-versus-them scenario, when in fact he was with them. Or, if that was not entirely accurate, he was certainly not with us. "Huh. How'd that happen?"
"I do not know. I am not in confidence with either of them. I am also unsure of Herr Drash's motivation regarding your pursuit and murder. He could not harbor an old antipathy for druids, since he was born long after all druids had disappeared from the earth save you, and he only heard of your existence recently. But it may simply be an issue of loyalty for him. His relationship with Theophilus has depths I cannot fathom."
"Well, how about the obvious?"
Granuel asked.
"Are they lovers?"
Leaf blinked.
"Oh, well, I hadn't considered that. Perhaps."
"Aha!" Granuel said, pointing at him, her face lit with victory.
"So that means vampires do have balls. Ever since the last time we saw you in Thessalonica, I've been wondering about that."
Leaf flinched as if Granuel had slapped him.
"You have?"
I grinned because I knew what she was up to. Leaf had a peculiar squeamishness about vampire biology and refused to discuss it. If she could cause enough discomfort, he might decide to leave.
"Well, yeah," she said, pressing the attack. "I mean, you're basically animated dead tissue, right? So why would any system from your human life still work if it's superfluous to the act of predation and converting blood to energy? I mean, I'm sure you'd have a vestigial sac dangling there, but there's no reason to suppose your nuts would still be churning out baby makers and testosterone like a regular dude's if that's not going to get you a night's supply of blood. But if Theophilus is sharing his sweet cadaver love with Werner, then I guess I was dead wrong about that, eh? Did you see what I did there? Hey, where are you going?"
"Excuse me,"
Leaf called over his shoulder, suddenly in a hurry to exit the restaurant. He was already halfway to the door. I laughed. I told him to get out and he ignored me, but bring up his pop rocks and he can't wait to leave. "Good call." I gave her a fist bump.
"Thanks. I hope I didn't pounce too early."
"Oh. We never got an answer, did we?" I doubted I'd ever learn the truth about vampires.
"No, but we got an incentive to get out of here. I don't want to walk into an ambush outside, and I'm not anxious to confront something called an arcane life leech."
"Neither am I, but we can't go yet. We don't have any money to pay for this fabulous food we're not eating."
"I would eat it if you'd let me lick it off your plate,"
Granuel said.
"We'll feed you, Oberon, but in depressingly human-sized bites."
The waiter stopped by to make sure everything was satisfactory, seeing that my monkfish remained undisturbed.
"Très délicieux,"
I told him. He removed himself from our sight, only to be replaced by a large man in a black beret with hyper-aggressive mutton chops. They were imperial expansionist chops, threatening to leap from his face onto mine and colonize it for the glory of a fill-in-the-blank god and monarch.
"Monsieur Sullivan," he growled.
"Oui."
He reached into his pocket and withdrew a large roll of euros. He dropped it onto the table and hauled his mutton chops away before they could execute an airdrop and establish a beachhead on my jaw. Apparently, that was all the welcome I would receive from the local pack. I said. Taciturn.
Aloof, Grognoil said.
Or starving.
He was also in a hurry to leave, and that was a hint in itself. Let's go.
Yes, let's.
But the food!
Grognoil abandoned her earlier promise to feed him tiny bites and put her plate on the chair next to her for Oberon's easy access. I peeled off some bills and left them on the table as Oberon hoovered up the turbo. We picked up our camouflaged weapons and the belts and exited. Oberon lamenting the waste of my monkfish.
There are starving puppies in Iowa who'd be grateful for that food, he said. But I could be grateful on their behalf.
Privately, I mourned with him. Dinner had not gone as I'd planned. I'd rather hope to do my best to be a communicative male and verbalize a feeling or three to Grognoil, demonstrating that I, at least, had evolved beyond grunting, but circumstances had stolen my opportunity. I hoped I would have another soon. The Strait of Dover, or from the French perspective, the Pas de Calais, beckoned us in the dark. The Morrigan had promised us a way out if we could make it to Hearn's Forest on the other side. Crossing the strait would leave us at our most vulnerable, and I seriously doubted Oberon's ability to swim 21 miles unaided. We waded out a short distance into the cold surf, where Grognoil gave me Scawaja, stripped, and donated her clothing to the tide. After a quick kiss, truly quick this time, she shifted to a sea lion. I cast night vision. All right, let's see what we can cook up. No matter what we do, we're going to increase your drag. But if we try to hook up something lengthwise, that's going to mess up your swimming motion. I think we're best off hooking you up bandolier style. I asked Oberon to hold on to our weapons for us on the beach while I got Grognoil rigged. It would not do to lose them in the surf. Using two of the belts, I slung them diagonally so that they passed over a flipper on one side and under it on the other, forming an X. I buckled them on her back and asked her to roll over. She did, presenting her belly. I fetched Scawaja from Oberon first and laid it crossways near the top of the X, just above her flippers, the theory being that she would not need to twist and flex right there as much as she would on her neck or her tail. At the two contact points with the belts, I bound the wood to the leather so that there was no possibility of detaching. I admired again the craftsmanship of Crania and the cleverness of Flittish. The bindings on Scawaja were carved in, and solid state, immune to my cold iron aura. I didn't know if Fragoral was like that or not, but I had always avoided touching the blade for fear of ruining the enchantments that made it so powerful. "Give that a try," I said. "Can you swim okay like that?" She heaved her bulk forward a bit awkwardly, with the staff riding high on her chest, and then dove into the waves. She disappeared for a full minute, but then exploded out of the surf in front of me and soaked me in salt water. "Very funny," I said. Grognoil laughed, but as a sea lion, it sounded like braying, and that made me laugh too and eased a bit of the tension I felt. "All right, let's add on Fragoraw and see what happens." I hadn't truly prepared it for a sea journey, but if we ever got to dry land again, I would pay plenty of attention to the blade and have Govnu give it some love. If nothing else, a gentle request to Ferris, the Iron Elemental, would allow me to pinpoint any problem areas and prevent developing rust. I was just taking Fragoraw from Oberon when his ears pricked up, and he looked to the south.
"Somebody's coming, Atticus. You might want to hold on to it."
I followed his gaze and saw a slim silhouette approaching. I triggered my magical sight and saw that the figure had an odd churning aura in green and orange. He had magical power of some kind, but there wasn't enough white in it to mark him as a god.
"Stay here," I said. "Be ready to go."
"Grognoil says we should bail and see if he can swim, whoever it is."
Examining his clothing, I saw that it was composed of natural materials, cotton and silk mostly.
"Nah, I got this," I said.
As I padded across the beach, I crafted a binding between the back of his suit jacket and the sand, but didn't energize it. I let it hang there, waiting for completion. I dispelled magical sight to get a clear look at him. The moon conspired with the ambient light of Calais to provide some decent illumination, and night vision did the rest. He had on some of those slick ankle boots like Leaf had been wearing, the kind with extra-long pointy toes. Not exactly beachwear. His suit was gray, with a gray paisley waistcoat and a silk cravat in an alarming soda pop orange writhed around his neck, seemingly aware of its own hideousness. It could be no other than Werner Drash. I had to admit that Leaf was right. He dressed like a dandy. But I think perhaps the idea behind the cravat was to distract from his face. His cheeks were entirely tattooed with alchemical symbols, the sort of squiggly signs that are reminiscent of astrology, but based in elemental magic. They didn't cross his nose or mouth, but they continued above his brow and onto his shaven scalp. I didn't have time to examine them closely, but I'm sure they weren't a random configuration. They were equations, formulae, and they represented a binding to the elements of life, the way my tattoos were binding to the earth. Leaf had called them odd cosmetic decisions, but that was either an understatement or a failure to understand what they represented. Probably the latter. A vampire would have no need to understand alchemy. I did not bother introducing myself. He knew who I was already. "Why are you looking for me?" I called while he was still 20 yards away. He answered me in German.
"Manche Leute muss man einfach umbringen," he said, and then reached into his suit and pulled a Glock 20 from a shoulder holster.
I energized the binding I'd made and watched him spread out his arms in a futile attempt to regain balance as he was yanked backward onto the beach and held there by his suit jacket. He held onto the gun, but he was spread-eagled now and unable to point it at me. I was a little bit stunned at his stone-cold attitude. He'd simply announced his intention to kill me and pulled a gun. If Leaf had been telling the truth, this was the lad who'd arranged to have me shot. Whether or not it was true, he just tried to kill me himself. And he was trying again, albeit in a different way. Raising his bald head from the sand and baring his teeth, he tried to drain me. I felt the hit on my cold iron amulet. It pulled away from my chest as if someone were tugging on it. My patience bid farewell. Though I would have much rather spoken with Herr Drash in an attempt to learn more about Theophilus, he had now put us on a kill-or-be-killed footing 3 different times. Removing Fragorov from its scabbard, I charged with the intention of decapitating him. But then a sudden thought caused me to change my mind. Instead, I brought the blade down hard on his right arm between the wrist and elbow, severing it and spraying blood on the sand.
"Manchen Leuten muss man einfach ihre Hände abhacken," I told him.
He bellowed incoherently as I sheathed Fragorov and picked up his amputated hand. Making sure he could see me, I removed the Glock 20 from its grip and tossed it into the ocean. Admiring the simplicity of it, I shrugged and followed up by tossing his hand in the ocean too. When Werner saw that, his roar went subhuman, and I felt through my tattoos that he was drawing energy from the earth, but not in the same way that I did. All the little microorganisms in the sand, any insects or small vertebrates nearby, he was draining them all since he couldn't drain me. I pointed Fragorov at him and said, "Stop that, or you lose the other hand." He stopped, taking loud gasps of breath between clenched teeth. But I noticed that his arm ceased squirting blood, and a flicker of orange lit his eyes. "Now that you're disarmed," I said in German, "I'm curious. You wish to kill me, but appear to know very little about what I can do. It leads me to speculate on your source of information. Since your source obviously left out some critical details regarding my abilities, perhaps he or she was less than honest regarding other things as well. Now, I will freely tell you that I was informed of your existence less than 30 minutes ago. This intelligence came from a vampire named Leif Helgerson." Werner Drash cursed creatively, and I smiled. "Ah, yes, we have both been played, you and I. Leif expected me to kill you before I could learn of his role in sending you after me. Am I correct in thinking your removal would allow him to get closer to Theophilus?" The Life Leech considered, then nodded. "And he warned me of your coming in order to gain a measure of my trust. but I have had occasion to learn that Mr. Helgerson does nothing that does not serve his own self-interest. Any information he provides that appears to help you actually helps him, and the same goes for his services. Now that you have had occasion to learn the same lesson in a very painful way, I said, flicking a finger at his stump, perhaps you and I can part without loss of life or further injury. Perhaps we can even find your hand. If I retrieve it, can you reattach it and heal?
Drash nodded. I have done it before.
Then, seeing as we are both victims of another's machinations, I propose a gentleman's agreement. First, we shall forgive each other our trespasses. Second, I will provide your severed limb so that you can be whole again. And third, henceforth we shall not trouble each other or conspire to do so with others. Live and let live in peace. Agreed? Werner Drash needed little time to weigh the advantages of this.
Agreed, he said, though I can speak only for myself and not for Theophilus.
Understood, I said. Your loyalty to him is admirable, though I would point out that right now Leif Helgerson is a far greater threat to Theophilus than I am. And a far greater threat to you, I might add, but act or not on this information as you will. It is not my business. Our business together is easily concluded, and I am happy that we could find some ground on which to agree.
Atticus, is everything okay?
Yeah, a misunderstanding. Going to see if I can give this guy a hand. Binding like to like, skin to skin, I created a bond between Drash's left hand and his right, which floated somewhere in the nearby tide. The binding found a target in the waves, and the right hand flew out of the water with a crab already attached to the trailing muscle tissue. Once Drash had given himself a low five, I dissolved the binding and shooed the crab away. There you go, sir, I said. I am a man of my word. Give me a moment to grant us both some space, and I will release you from the sand. I hope that if we ever meet again, we can do so amicably and partake of something potable. May harmony find you. Werner Drash said nothing as I took my leave. He just fixed me with a glare of stone and watched me go. Once I reached the spot where Oberon waited, I dissolved the binding on Werner's suit jacket. He sat up and cradled a stump, holding his hand next to it. I switched to the magical spectrum and saw the life leech swell with stolen energy, his arms suffused with the white light of magic. It took him less than a minute to complete the operation. I saw him hold up the hand and flex the fingers as if it hadn't been dinner for a crab in the recent past. That was more than a little scary. He healed far faster than I did. Faster than vampires and werewolves, too. And it was entirely at the expense of other living creatures nearby. By all rights, I should have killed him for the abomination he was. But that was a moral path through deep woods that kept spiraling in on itself until there was no more abominations to kill but myself. Maybe Werner Drash would give me another reason to kill him in the future. A reason that hadn't been conveniently provided by Leif Helgerson. I could not expect a second confrontation with him to be so easily won as the first. But let that song be sung when it would. For now, refusing to be a pawn in Leif's power games would suffice to keep me happy. The arcane life leech stood, brushed himself off, and nodded once at me before turning toward the lights of Calais. I expected he would give Leif a little bit of trouble or, at minimum, speak some poison into the ear of Theophilus, and that would be satisfying as well. Silhouettes rushed out of the city to meet Herr Drash, and I saw by their gray auras and the red lights in their heads and chests that they were vampires. Werner Drash was definitely not a neutral figure. He was an enemy to whom I'd shown mercy. Three of them remained with Drash, but two passed him and ran in my direction. Further evidence that his circle of acquaintances knew very little about me. I unbound both vampires before they could get close. They melted messily into the sand. I was not neutral either.
Can we go now? Because I'm really anxious to start asking you, are we there yet?
Yeah, buddy. I waded out to Granuel and bound Fragra on top of Scowaja, then tied the holster of throwing knives on top of that. If we're going to drown our sorrows in the literal sense, let's get it over with. Chapter 18. The first 100 yards or so was largely an effort on Oberon's part to properly express how cold the water was.
"My nether regions have immigrated to my core and might never return. Maybe they'll send me a postcard."
He was pretty slow in the water, and I wasn't much faster. Sea otters typically chase down sea urchins, which tend to have the top speed of a snail, so speed wasn't at a premium. But Granuel's staff, sticking out horizontally from where we'd bound it, performed a valuable service. Oberon was able to drape his forelegs over it and keep his head above water and kick with his back legs. I did the same on the other side, and together we were able to make about 10 miles per hour. 2 hours wouldn't be so bad, I figured, if no one messed with us, but that was far too much to hope for. Avoiding the shipping was a challenge in itself. The Strait of Dover was one of the busiest waterways in the world, and we had to add on a bit of distance by swimming outside those lanes. We saw nothing for the first few miles except the next choppy wave that wanted to slap us in the whiskers. The white cliffs of Dover eventually appeared in our night vision. They had some white magic about them in the magical spectrum. Someone had cast wards over them, though I could not tell what kind at that distance. When we swam past the halfway point without incident, I allowed myself to feel the faint stirrings of hope. And, directly afterward, I felt faint stirrings in the sea. Something was moving beneath us. The strait was 20 to 30 fathoms deep, and something down there was displacing a substantial amount of water. Something of leviathan proportions. Rising. My imagination filled with a tentacled horror reaching up from the dark to pull us down for dinner. Krakens, to me, are so much more terrifying than sharks, though I do not know why it should be so. More people are bitten by sharks than eaten by krakens every year, but seeing a shark would have been reassuring right then. A shark, somehow, was merely a predator doing its predator thing, where a kraken was an unholy monster that sent sailors, and druids, shrieking from their bunks. I'm aware that my fear and loathing of krakens is unjustified. After all, they bear me no more ill will than I bear to lunch meat. But fear and rationality are hardly good drinking buddies. I'm fairly certain one of them doesn't even drink. When I'm on dry land, I can set aside my dread and even feel sorry for krakens because nobody loves them. It is a desolate feeling to crawl about the crust of the world unloved, and though most of us have never spent a single moment bereft of love, we can sense the emptiness of it and fear it, can sympathize with J. Alfred Prufrock and all such people unmoored from the shores of humanity. But my empathy for krakens dissolves in the water when we may be swimming in the same body of it. Night vision, I discovered, does little good in the water past a couple dozen feet. If something decided to swim up from beneath us very fast, I would have almost no time to swim out of the way, assuming I could. And Oberon was about as agile in the water as a lily pad. Magic sight was slightly better. The auras of living things have their own light and don't give a damn how far away they are from the sun or moon. But the sea is full of living things, and as I peered into the deep, I had quite a bit of filtering to do before I could see anything more than visual noise and get a sense of distance. If I was having trouble, I imagined Granuel was bewildered. She could interpret what she saw very well, but still had difficulty penetrating the non-essential bindings. When I finally identified the threat, it was so close that I nearly shat kine. It wasn't a kraken at all. It was a chorus of 7 great serpents, spawn of your Moongander, swollen to monstrous size and rising below us to the left. Wainamoinen had told me of his encounter with one of them long ago, otherwise I would not have recognized them. Sentient but shy creatures that preferred to dine on blue whales, they never would have pursued us without goading. They preferred the deep ocean and rose to the surface only in their youth to satisfy their curiosity. Poseidon and Neptune were whipping them doubly against their natures. To eat food they'd never seek out on their own, and in a portion of the sea they habitually avoided. Frantically seizing on the threads of their consciousness one by one, I shouted the concept of poison to them as best as I could. One turned away. Then another. One that I hadn't shouted at turned away, so Granuel must have been doing something similar. Four were still rising fast, and opening jaws that would gulp us down like goldfish. I got one more, and two others peeled off to erupt from the surface nearby. But for the final one, a gigantic yawning darkness rimmed in teeth, there was simply no time. I had a Hamlet moment as death approached. The famous Dane had marveled in the graveyard at how imperious Caesar, dead and turned to clay, might stop a hole to keep the wind away. And I wondered at how I could live so long and survive so many wars to wind up as snake shit. Something massive rammed into the serpent's neck right below the head. It came in from the north, and I never saw it coming because I'd been looking down. The collision caused the serpent to change course just enough to miss our tails. It still exploded through the surface along with the six other serpents, and the resulting turbulence tumbled us ass over tea kettle deeper into the water. This wasn't a problem for Granuel or me, but it was a significant issue for Oberon, who'd had no warning at all of the attack.
"Atticus, help! The sky is gone! What's happening?"
I couldn't answer him specifically because I honestly didn't know. The churning of the sea continued to pull me in directions I didn't want to go, and I was helpless to fight against it. I couldn't even see him. I caught a flash of Granuel's sleek shape twisting away from me, either above or below, I couldn't tell which, and saw the shining trunks of serpents surrounding me like scaly towers. Everything else was dark, and I couldn't tell which way was up. The huge creature that had butted into the last serpent flickered in my vision. A shark, perhaps, but strangely limbed in white magic. And then the serpents crashed back into the sea again and made it all worse. That told me where the surface was, at least.
"Can't breathe! Atticus! Water!"
Oberon's clear panic was infectious, and I struggled to right myself. I didn't know where he was and couldn't think of how to help him even if I did. "Find Granuel if you can," I told him. It was his best hope, slim as it was. The serpents would be coming around for another pass. Poseidon and Neptune wouldn't let them give up.
"Oh, wait!"
I didn't know what I was supposed to wait for. I began to shout, "Flee!" at the serpents to try to clear them out, but all that accomplished was another short-term reprieve from becoming an hors d'oeuvre. The Olympians were urging the serpents to eat us as quickly as I could urge them to forget about it, and so for every time I convinced one to swim in a different direction, it would swing back around a few moments later as I switched my attention to another set of jaws. It wasn't sustainable. My magic was draining rapidly out of my bear charm. Soon, I would have no way to communicate to the creatures, and that would be the end. I missed one diving from above, but Granuel must have spotted it, for a serpent plunged right past me, its scales scraping my fur and its tidal gravity pulling me deeper with it, tumbling me in swirls of current and confusing my sense of direction once more. My lungs burned, reminding me that breathing air was not optional, but the surface was a mystery to me now.
"Atticus, where are you?"
Oberon's plaintive tone was heartbreaking. "I don't know, buddy. I'm sorry." I managed to fight free of the serpent's wake and searched for anything in the darkness that would tell me which way was up. Two glowing white figures drew my attention, the lambent glow of godhood. Poseidon and Neptune, calmly floating in their element and directing the chaos. Their heads told me which way was up, and I began to swim desperately for the surface. I didn't know anything was closing on me from behind until it plowed into my rear. It splayed my legs wide across its smooth bulk as it rose rapidly toward the surface. Energy abruptly flooded my tissues, and I finally understood. It was Manannan MacLear in his aquatic form as a killer whale. A killer whale capable of magnifying his natural strength and speed and drawing Gaia's strength directly from the water. And, as I had done many times in the past with Granuel and Oberon, he was now sharing some of that strength with me through skin-to-skin contact that slipped past my aura, while giving me an express ride to the surface. It was he who had delivered a headbutt to the seventh serpent, and perhaps had helped distract the others. Odin had totally earned his Samoas and whiskey. The stars never shone so bright as when we splashed through the surface and the blackness sheeted away from my eyes. I gasped a lungful of sweet, salty air, and then had to hold it in as Monadon dove again, so quickly that I slipped off his back as he darted away.
"He found you,"
Oberon said, and the victory in his tone reassured me. "Yes, but I think he's left me behind now."
"He's coming back to fetch me, and Guanyuel is here too. Follow north, and he will wait for you to catch up. He says to climb up on his back with me, and not to worry. He and Clever Girl are keeping the snakes busy."
Indeed they were. A quick survey of my surroundings revealed that the spawn of Jormungandr were thrashing about in the sea, tossing the waves as if apoplexed. The Olympians urged them to violence, while we druids urged them to peace, and it was in their nature to side with us. The Morgan's words came back to me. Gaia loves us more than she loves the Olympians. They might have the power to coerce her creatures and usurp her magic to some extent, but in the end they were bound to their worshippers, whereas we were bound to the earth itself. Now that I was finally able to see them clearly, the children of Jormungandr proved to be as beautiful as they were terrifying. Blue-green scales, just as Vinamoinen described, shedding sheets of water and glinting in the moonlight, covering everything except for membranous tissue stretched between five bony ridges that fanned out from the top of the head. I didn't see gigantic fangs. I thought all the teeth were pretty large, and perhaps the ones on the edges were a bit plus-sized. And it hadn't been my imagination in the sea that their mouths were giant black holes. They really were. Inside, the cheeks and tongue were not pink or red, but a scaly asphalt, as though something else flowed through their veins besides blood. Overlarge eyes like oil puddles helped them see in the gloom of the deep, and their gills flared beneath their jaws, horizontal shadows slashing across the scales. Monanon's back and dorsal fin floated on top of the waves about a minute's fast swim from where he lost me. A sodden wolfhound huddled around the front edge of the fin, his paws hugging either side of it, and his head resting against its left side, facing the tail. I scrambled up the side and bounded toward him until I could leap on his back and hold on with my otter paws. "Okay, let's go," I said. "If Granuel is ready, that is." Oberon's mental voice spoke in an abominable caricature of pirate speech.
"Arr, that she is, matey. Swimming a fathom deep to starboard, or port, whatever direction that is. It matters not, because I'm a salty dog. Arr!"
I didn't reply for fear I would encourage him. Monanon pulled away from the boiling cauldron of serpents, which were thrashing impotently under the conflicting commands of Olympians and druids. For about 15 seconds, I harbored hope of a clean escape. And then two arrows fell out of the sky and sank into Monanon's back, right behind the dorsal fin. He shuddered and almost dove by instinct before he remembered he had to keep Oberon topside. I squinted through the night and, past the writhing trunks of serpents, saw two white-veiled forms skipping across the waves on giant clamshells pulled by dolphins. Those were the chariots of Poseidon and Neptune, but they now carried Artemis and Diana, who had obviously regenerated and caught up to us. But they were out of their element now. It was an awfully choppy ride through the sea serpent mosh pit, and they couldn't be as accurate with their arrows as they wished, but they were still bloody dangerous, and I didn't want to give them any more free shots. Luckily, in their haste to catch up to us in the strait, they had forgotten to take proper precautions with their mode of transport. Clamshells are all natural. If I could have grinned widely as an otter, I would have. Using energy provided by Monanon MacLear, I bound the shells to the bottom of the channel. That dumped the huntresses into the strait and prevented them from firing on us. I released the binding almost immediately, because I didn't want to hurt the dolphins towing them. But those poor sea serpents were probably working up an appetite with all that thrashing around. I shot an idea to Granuel and Monanon via Oberon. Monsters tend to like virgins in the old stories. Two things happened at the same time. Poseidon and Neptune realized that their goddesses were in trouble and stopped pushing the serpents to eat us. And we encouraged the serpents to eat the goddesses. Oh, it was a thing of beauty. All seven of them whipped around and dove after the huntresses in a swirling eddy of scales and flesh, and then disappeared beneath the waves. Mm-mm. Goddess Tartar. Double down. We had no idea if one snake had eaten both or if they'd gone into different digestive systems. It didn't really matter. We told all the serpents to flee, and that's what they did, streaking for the open Atlantic and deeper water. Poseidon and Neptune would rescue Artemis and Diana, of course, and the goddesses would eventually resume their hunt, but there was no way they'd keep us from reaching England now. I stupidly thought we had won. Chapter 19. Mananon required a bit of triage once we reached the narrow strip of beach between the white cliffs and the western docks of the port. The arrows sticking out of his back weren't made of natural materials, and there was nothing we could do but tear them out. He would heal fine, but I suspected he would have precious little patience for the Olympians from now on. Through Oberon, he communicated that he would leave us there and remain in the strait to monitor developments. Though I wanted to ask him about the Morrigan. Did he bear her to Tir na n'Og? Was she at peace now? And so much more. It was neither practical nor appropriate to speak of such things through my hound. So we thanked him and bade him farewell. He swam off, the holes in his back already closed up. I shifted to human first and unbuckled the belts on Granuel's back after unbinding our weapons. Granuel shifted to human and waded out of the surf with Oberon, who shook himself and sprayed us with hound-scented salt water. All right, let's get the hell off this plane and thumb our noses at the Olympians, I said. There should be a small coppice of trees tethered to Tir na n'Og nearby. Skirting the city in camouflage, we crossed Military Road and then Folkestone Road, which led us to Elm's Wood, a sliver of untouched forest that had served as a border between farms for centuries. We placed our hands, and paws, against the trunk of an elm and searched for the connection to the Fey Plain. It wasn't there.
No, not here too!
Granuel said, slapping the tree trunk in frustration.
How'd they get here ahead of us?
They've known where we were headed for a while now, I said, then added, damn it.
So they've managed to corrupt the forest here too?
Yes.
What are we going to do? Go get some bangers and mash?
We'll go to Kent. There's an old way there that might not be guarded. And if it is, we'll go just a bit beyond and get what sleep we can during the day before pressing on to Windsor. There's not enough time to make it there before dawn, and I think we should hit it during the night if we can. Following the procedures we used in our run across Europe, I shifted to a stag and remained visible while Granuel and Oberon followed in concealment. Running through England was a bit nostalgic for me, having spent quite a bit of time there at various points of my life, but the countryside was far more developed. There used to be more old ways, but many had been destroyed in the name of progress, eaten up by the modern world, and there was no real incentive to make any more in protected areas when the system of using trees to shift had been so dependable until recently. Still, even at night, we ran through some stretches of English countryside that were utterly sublime. Oberon spotted a herd of sheep sleeping in a pasture and begged me to let him go mess with them.
Come on, Atticus. If we scare enough wool off them, you can make me a sweater with the huge O on the back. I'll wear it to the dog park and everything.
We don't want to wake anyone up, Oberon, including the sheep. And you don't really want to be a rascally sheep biter. You would come by some notable shame.
But they're so fluffy.
When I didn't respond, he appealed to Granuel.
Clever girl, intercede on my behalf. We'll go over there and bark a bit, and they'll all wake up and bleat in a charming British accent, and then we'll move on. It won't take 2 years.
After a brief pause, I heard him say,
Minutes, years, you know what I mean.
Oberon, I'm sorry we've had days and days with no fun at all, but I promise we will make this up to you with something really good. Sensing weakness, my hound immediately switched into negotiation mode.
I want a crazy cinnamon-coated poodle named Nutmeg. And I mean crazy, the kind that barks at fire hydrants and pees on mailmen.
I'm not sure we can guarantee something that specific, but it will definitely make up for all this. Kent had more preserved woodland than some other bits of England, with small named stands of timber breaking up the farmland and sheep pastures. A stretch of trees west of Sevenoaks called Millbank Wood was home to the only old way that lay across our path to Windsor. A boulder, hidden under mouldering leaves, concealed a chute that led to a memorial for Lew Lawada in Tiernanogue. We approached it cautiously, expecting it to be guarded by fae or monsters or human mercs. None of that turned out to be true. Instead, when we arrived, we discovered the boulder had been reduced to rubble, and the earth churned around the place, effectively destroying the passage to Tiernanogue. I couldn't muster the outrage to curse our luck. It wasn't luck, anyway, but further evidence of a carefully coordinated campaign against us. We moved on, but I didn't tell Granuel or Oberon where we were going or why, in hopes of foiling attempts to divine our destination from here. Directly west, perhaps 2 or 3 miles, behind the French Street burial ground, the long wood offered concealment and a place to sleep, and it said something about my exhaustion that I was too tired to make an adolescent joke about its name. It was damp and smelled a bit of rot after a recent rain, but it was safe for the moment. I shifted to human and said, "Let's sack out here for the day," since it was only an hour before dawn. Granuel shifted and said,
"Can we afford the time?"
I shrugged. "I figure we have a little bit, yeah. The Huntresses probably need brand new bodies and chariots, and they have to pick up our trail somewhere on the Dover coast. We're coming to the end, though, and we can't let them be all refreshed when we're not. You and Oberon sleep. I'll watch for a while and then wake you up to take a turn." Granuel drew close to me and planted a soft kiss on my lips.
"No arguments here. I'm exhausted."
Granuel curled up on the ground, and Oberon sprawled next to her. Both of them drifted off in a couple of minutes, and I was left to think about how we would survive going forward. If, somehow, we could defuse tensions with the Olympians, our priority had to be the mystery in Tiernanogue. Whoever was divining Granuel's location was also responsible for sending the dark elves and vampires after us. Strangely, the safest place for us would be Tiernanogue. Neither vampires nor dark elves would be tolerated there. Shuttling them through using the old ways was one thing, and easily hidden, especially for someone like Lord Grundlebeard, who controlled the Rangers. But keeping them in Tiernanogue for an extended period, as they came after me, would raise all sorts of alarms and questions that this shady adversary would wish to avoid. And, as for the remaining threat, the Fae, I had a distinct advantage where they were concerned. If I could find a safe place to leave Granuel and Oberon, I could go solo and perhaps surprise Mir or Lord Grundlebeard. If they were behind this, they'd expect me to stay next to Granuel and wouldn't be able to use divination to see me coming. I let Granuel sleep until mid-morning, before waking her up to take a watch.
"I needed that,"
she said, stretching languorously and perhaps a bit teasingly.
"Thanks."
She levered herself up, but Oberon barely stirred.
Poor hound.
"You're welcome. Wake me up mid-afternoon. We'll go get some clothes." I stretched out next to Oberon and stopped fighting my fatigue.